Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. This is the time and place set for the annual rules hearing of the South Dakota Supreme Court. Notice of the hearing has been published through the State Bar Newsletter, and we have before us today several proposals that we'll proceed through as they've been filed with the court. This is a fairly informal proceeding. It's not like an oral argument. If you wish to speak, we'll ask the proponents to come up first and then the opponents after that. The first one is proposed rule number one, which amend SDCL 1566D. My understanding, filed by the State Bar. Mr. Barnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Justices, Tom Barnett, State Bar. As the court notes, the first rule came from our practice rules committee. We were asking the court to defer any action on it. Our committee missed the process last year where Rule 56 was amended, and Rule 56 and Rule 6 are currently in conflict. And so what I've asked that committee to do is go back to the drawing board, and at the next rules hearing of the Supreme Court, that we bring a proposal back that would get the two rules in sync, and that's why we're asking you to pull that.
All right. Any objection to the State Bar's request to pulling rule number one?
Did you receive any of the... We did receive a letter in opposition to it. Have you had the opportunity to see that?
I've not seen the letter to... I have not seen that, Justice.
Perhaps the committee might want to at least look at that.
Thank you.
All right. Then there is a group of proposals. That would be two through... nine. And probably take those all at once. All if you want to talk about an individual rule, that's just fine. Mr. Barnett, you maybe have some background information on how this got to us.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I think it was in 1991 or two that I brought to this court the original rule to define and regulate paralegals or legal assistants. Up until that point, there's no statutes and there were no rules on it. And whether the public policy reason for me bringing it to the court was twofold. One, that paralegals are an extension of lawyers, and it was appropriate for this court to regulate paralegals. And secondly, I had picked up in other jurisdictions that the legislature was starting to regulate that. And so there was a void, and I wanted the court to fill that, and the court, in fact, did. That was, however long ago, that was 16 years ago or so. One of the things that we permitted was for, just like Archie Bangs, Horace Jackson, that the court knew, of course, they read the law. You can't read the law anymore. You must graduate from an ABA law school and pass the bar exam. Anecdotally, I will note that about 2 years ago, Judge Hoyt ruled in reviewing some billings that those paralegals who the lawyer certified through on-the-job experience in his court would not be permitted. That if they had not been certified or graduated from the school, that they would not, for purposes of bankruptcy court, be treated as paralegals. Now, about 8 years ago, the committee established by the State Bar started to look at whether or not we should be more formal. They brought a proposal, and the bar was not happy with it. Our members were not happy or satisfied with it, and we sent them back to the drawing board. They've worked very hard the last few years, And they brought this proposal that's before the court to the annual meeting this June. Now, that committee has been chaired by Mariah Roman Rogers for 4 or 5 years, I think. And so she chaired it. She brought that work. She presented it at the annual meeting. And frankly, the membership voted in favor of that overwhelmingly. Mr. Nacer had some objections, and there were a couple others that were opposed, but it was probably 90 to 10 in favor. I'm not going to address the actual rules. I've got Mariah here to do that, but I thought the court might benefit somewhat from the background on where we got to where we are today.
Thank you, Mr. Barnett. Appreciate it. Okay. Ms. Rogers, can we hear from you, please?
Good morning. I'm Mariah Roman Rogers, and I am the chair of the Legal Assistance Committee for the State Bar. And it's been 15 years since I had the honor of being before the court, so it's nice to be back. I don't know if you have specific questions for me, but I just briefly glanced at Dean Nazer's letter to the court regarding the rule changes, and I'll comment on those as best I can after I make a couple other comments. We've been working for the last 2 years with the South Dakota Paralegal Association trying to revise the statute that the rule that this court originally passed, I believe, in 1992 and then revised in 1995. The 1995 revision, if you review it, added in an expectation that the paralegal would be familiar with the rules of professional conduct. The original rule as we had it didn't say anything in there about that. At that time, there were some issues with a few attorneys who had been disbarred, and I believe that might have been the reason that the rules of professional responsibility were added at that time. The SDPA, the South Dakota Paralegal Association, has a member on our bar committee, and so I've worked with several of the presidents over the years. Terry Braun, who's here today, she was the president of the SDPA back in 1998, I believe, when this issue, we talked about it for years, and then just the last couple of years, we've actually accomplished something. So we always have a member from the SDPA on our bar committee. And we work with them. We were brought this idea. Our committee worked on it. There was some conflict within the SDPA itself about how to approach it, so we threw it back to them, had their membership talk about it. They brought it back to us. Our committee looked at it, and then we took it to the bar, as Tom has already told you. While we've been talking about this the last year, we've done our best to educate the bar about this particular rule regarding paralegals, and it's amazing how many attorneys don't know that there is a rule. A lot of attorneys don't know the difference between a legal assistant and a paralegal. There isn't one, but for some reason everyone thinks a legal assistant is something more than a legal secretary, but not quite a paralegal, which is why one of the changes that we've suggested is getting rid of the word legal assistant and using the word paralegal. And then the more substantive changes are found in the first, I think it's 16.18.34.1, which has to do with the qualifications. Essentially, what we've suggested is getting rid of the on-the-job training type of way to become a paralegal, and we're suggesting that either people go to a paralegal school and get a degree, or they become certified. And most certifications, I included in my letter to the court what the different certifying groups require, but generally you have to have 5 to 7 years of experience working in a law firm to qualify to be certified. Mr. Nazer and I respectfully disagree about the effect of this law or this rule change, and I have lots of my students who graduate from paralegal school who really serve in that secretary slash paralegal role. We don't make a huge distinction in South Dakota between somebody who does paralegal work, and some firms do, but the smaller ones don't. And I have many students who are in larger firms and some that are in the small ones. But and so I don't see this as putting people out of business or raising the cost of legal services. I also take issue with the idea that this is being pushed by a certified group. The South Dakota Paralegal Association does not require its members to be certified. We have lots of different You know, we have the ones that have the on-the-job training. We have some that have been certified. We do have some that have gone to the ABA, you know, like my students who graduate. So it isn't a push to make everybody certified. I believe what the purpose behind this is to change the profession just a little bit so that there are now standards for them. Anybody who's currently working as a paralegal is grandfathered in. Everyone else, this is sort of a starting point. From now on, here's how we'd like to do it. But anyway, so, and I also believe that Dean's wife, Carol, would actually qualify or be grandfathered in. She's a pharmacist, so of course she doesn't have legal background or legal training, but through the years of experience and her training with Dean, she most likely would qualify. So I don't know if you have any questions for me.
I have a couple questions. Could individuals still call themselves legal assistants and therefore not bring themselves under the purview of the paralegal statutes?
If we change the terminology and get rid of legal assistant, then I think anybody could be called a legal assistant. The last time I was in Sioux Falls, I was looking through the classified, and there was a job opening for a county employee, what was called a legal assistant too. The only thing that was required was the person have a GED. And that really sort of is, well, you know, if you're a person who's gone to paralegal school and becomes certified, and you're being put in the same class as someone who has a GED with no experience, it really doesn't acknowledge what they've done. Some of these people that work in the paralegal profession have attained a lot of education, and the certification only adds to that. It's more of an incentive than it is, you know.
Do you think there would be any, let me go back to that first question. If I understand correctly, I need to beat this to death a little bit. If there's a concern by some that they don't want to have to comply with the paralegal rules, they could still work for a lawyer and be legal assistants, and the lawyer could call this as my legal assistant as opposed to secretary. These provisions wouldn't prohibit that in any way.
Not from my reading of them, and honestly, there's nothing in this particular statute that talks about how you can bill that person. I suppose you could probably bill your legal secretary time. No one does that. And it's amazing how many office managers for larger law offices and lawyers that just really don't understand how this law works. The thing that's most amazing to me is that they don't understand that if the paralegal violates the rules of professional responsibility, it does reflect back upon them. Because they're the one with the law license, and that really is how that all works. So we've really done our best to try to educate people.
When I've read your materials, I looked at the various state systems, and maybe I missed it, but it seems to me we would be the first state to adopt a scheme like this one. Is that right?
We are one of the first ones. I believe I also included materials, and I might not have, but Florida has just gone to a two-tiered sort of system. It's very similar where they have like a group of people that through education are one tier, and then there's a second tier for people that have attained certification. And I also included all the materials on Wisconsin because they're sort of the one everyone's looking to right now because they have that pending licensure. And I don't think that we're at that stage by any means. I don't think Tom wants to start licensing paralegals. I think he has his hands full with who he has. So, but I do think that is going to change. There's a lot of people in the industry that think that will be sort of a domino effect, that it will, once Wisconsin accepts licensing, if they do. It's finally made it up to the docket. It's been on there since, I think it was 2004 that they submitted that petition. So they're just, it's like number three on the docket now.
Shouldn't we continue to have a category other than certified paralegal, where a person, you know, even beyond the grandfathering time, where a person can become, qualified in a second category, assuming they don't want to go to school in Rapid City or Sioux Falls, but they want to stay in Huron or some small town. Shouldn't we also have that category that continues to exist even beyond the period of time where the grandfathering ends?
Well, I think that the only problem that we've had with the way that we do it now is that the attorneys really are too busy a lot of the time to truly do that on the job. I can't remember how the statute reads exactly, but it says something about a special program for, I can't remember what it says, the in-house training as a paralegal under a particular program. So, you know, certainly that is always an option. The other thing that's a little scary in the world that we have now are the internet degrees that you can get. You know, you go, you get an internet degree in 6 weeks and you're a paralegal. I have been contacted. My school actually has, I can't remember, I think it's called Ed2Go through our Business Industry Training Center, and they do have some paralegal classes that you can take. And a woman did take some of those classes, and then she contacted me, and she was really quite irate that I didn't consider her to be the equivalent of one of my students who had gone to school with me for 2 years. So, you know, that is, if you live in a very small community, that might be the only way you can get some of your education is on the internet, but I don't think it's the equivalent of certification. And the certification process really does acknowledge somebody who's been working in the law office getting the on-the-job training because it's required in order to sit for the exam.
I'd like to go back to Justice Konenkamp's first question about the practical effect of this. What about that secretary that isn't going to be a paralegal, but, you know, bankruptcy, divorce, whatever it is, they're basically, they know how to do everything, and they're doing everything for you. I thought I heard you say it wouldn't really have any effect for that kind of a person, but yet, I mean, the things I see right off are, in 1618.34, it says that the rule applies to anyone who the attorney represents to the public as possessing training or education. So if they weren't certified, if they didn't meet the definition of a paralegal,
sure.
What are you going to do with, you know, your right-hand person that does everything, that goes with you, that's meeting with the client, collecting the information, maybe filling out the bankruptcy schedules or, getting the property together for the divorce or whatever? Can you say, this is my legal assistant?
Well, I think
this is passed.
If we change things, then I do think that legal assistant would be an appropriate title for that person.
Inappropriate?
Inappropriate. It would be okay.
It'd be okay to say.
Okay, to say they're my legal assistant. However, I think that kind of gets into more of the billing question again. How do those attorneys, and I'm no expert at bankruptcy, my brother's a bankruptcy attorney, but I don't know, do they typically, in a bankruptcy, do they bill out their paralegal time, or does the paralegal just do it and it's a set fee schedule? I'm not quite sure how.
Well, it doesn't have to be bankruptcy. I mean, it can be a lot of things.
Right.
The billing, then that was going to be my follow-up. Subsection 6 of the ethical considerations. 10, says an attorney may charge for a paralegal. That's on page 5 of the...
That would be assuming that would be the person who qualifies as a paralegal, not the legal assistant, if it's...
So by implication, then, are we saying that you may not charge for a legal assistant?
Well, I don't know. It says that you may charge. That doesn't say that you can't charge for the other one.
So
I'm not answering your question, I know, because I don't know the answer. So.
Yeah, all right, that's fair. Then... what about subsection 6 then as well? Paralegals who deal with the client must be identified. What if you want to use a legal assistant? What effect? I suppose you don't know the answer to that either.
Well, I think that, you know, most of our clients that come into our offices really don't know the difference between all the different players in the firm anyway. I'm not by any means saying that these legal secretaries who've worked there for 20 years have a different professionalism than a paralegal. They're all very competent. They, you know, the legal secretaries may not know the formal rules of professional conduct, but they've been trained to respect their client's privacy. They're trained to handle client confidences, and they're working daily. They're answering the phones. They're dealing with the people. We all know that the lawyers don't have time to talk to people, and it's the secretaries and paralegals that handle a lot of the day-to-day stuff. So I think as long as everyone knows who everyone is, it really is just making the paralegal, that person has a different set of qualifications. It doesn't say that, you know, the paralegal only does these certain jobs. Paralegals do a lot of secretarial things, just as the secretaries really cross over into the paralegal field. I think it's just, again, it's a step to recognize the paralegals as being separate from a legal secretary.
Somehow we're going to have to be told, though, what the effect of this is on that legal assistant. You know, in these areas I just discussed, because the lawyers are going to want to know, they're going to have legal assistance, and, you know, can they represent to the public that they have a legal assistant? Can they let them deal directly with the attorney, and can they charge? Those are the three things I see.
Well, I think that this rule has actually never addressed those problems, which maybe is why since 1991 or two, nobody's really all that aware of it, because there are some holes in it. And what we did was try to work best with what we already had, you know, what was proposed originally and then modified. And it probably could use some tweaking of sorts, so to cover those things. And then maybe everybody would be more comfortable with it.
Isn't paragraph 10, subsection 10, the only authority that previously existed to permit a lawyer for charging for a legal assistant and setting a charge for legal services?
That's the only one I've ever seen, and of course,
so now they've deleted legal assistant, right?
We're just changing the terminology. It does used to say,
deleting legal assistant, so now you can't charge for legal assistance, right?
Right, but a legal assistant and a paralegal are the same thing.
Would have been the same thing, but for this new rule.
Right. Now we're eliminating the term legal assistant.
Right. So now you can't charge for a legal assistant.
No.
Right.
No. No means yes. What did that mean?
No, you can't charge for the legal assistant. You can charge for the paralegal.
Okay.
You know, this is such a new rule, and I understand most of the bar last meeting didn't have any objection to this. We haven't heard from Mr. Nasa this morning, but obviously...
Yes, Dean was actually, where we respectfully agree to disagree on this. Dean was the only person in the whole... I mean, we sent out, if you read the bar newsletter, we sent out lots of requests. You know, let us know how you feel about this. Dean was the only person. Now, I don't think Dean is the only person that objects. I think actually more of the objections come from the Sioux Falls side of the state than the Rapid City side, and I can't explain that at all, but... there seems to be more contention over there regarding it, or at least what I've heard. It could just be because I've heard from Dean, but it does seem like there's more over there than there is on this side, on the west side of the state.
Do you think there'd be any virtue to, because of the nature of this rule and because it's going to have perhaps some effect upon how lawyers and their assistants work, that it might be advisable for us to perhaps make it effective a year from now? Say January of 08, that gives everybody a chance to kind of start working with the rule without having it actually be in effect until for a year. Do you see some virtue in that?
Sure, and, you know, maybe we can, you know, do some CLEs or something also to get some education out there. We've tried, but again, that was one of the reasons we put the letter. I think Dean attached it to his letter with the different scenarios in it, trying to help people figure it out as well. So,
has there ever been since these have been in existence, has there been any activity as far as reporting somebody that hadn't been supervising a legal assistant?
I do know that when Terry Braun was the president of the SDPA, there was a problem with a paralegal, and I don't remember the whole story. She could probably answer that better.
And the other question, changing the terminology and to paralegal, does that leave then less of a burden or no burden on the attorney to supervise and require all these things from their legal assistant?
Well, I think anybody other than a paralegal falls into just your general office staff. whether you call them their a legal secretary or a legal assistant, which would now not be a paralegal but something else, and or, you know, I don't know, people come up with different terms for the paralegal. But I'm done. Thank you.
Mr. Barnett, looks like you want to get in a word.
With permission of the court, I'd like to address a couple of the issues that have piqued your interest. Lawyers, under the rules of professional conduct, may not charge for secretarial time. They cannot. They can charge for paralegal time. They can charge for legal assistant time under the existing rule. Everybody who has been charging for, whether they called them a paralegal or legal assistant, can charge a reasonable rate given their experience and or their training. So we're not changing anything. Prospectively, it is a change. It's a substantive change. They must now, if the court approves this rule, go through the certification process. Assuming that they do, then the lawyer has the right. These people command higher salaries, reflecting their training and their experience. And they're allowed to, the lawyer or the law firm is allowed to charge for that. We haven't changed anything. All those people who are currently legal assistants and whose law firms have decided they meet the qualifications, Justice Sinner, you referred to the bankruptcy situation. Certainly, the person who's does all those schedules and have been doing it for 20 years, I can assure you that the current practice is that if they're not a flat fee, they are going to build into their billing process a fee for that experience. They can't charge for the legal secretary that just pounds out paper. Now, all those people that have already qualified are going to continue to qualify. So we're not changing anything other than prospectively they have to be certified. And so under the rules of professional conduct, they cannot charge for secretarial time. They can charge for paralegal time, and we're not proposing to change anything.
But if I understand, even after this rule, if we do implement it, even after it's implemented, a lawyer could still have a legal assistant and a paralegal and could charge for both of those.
I disagree, Justice, with respect. I think prospectively, if a lawyer simply says, this person who I just hired is not a paralegal because they don't meet the qualifications of the rule, the requirements of the rule, so I'm going to call them a legal assistant. They cannot, under the rules of professional conduct, then charge for that person.
All right.
Okay. They can call them a legal assistant, but they can't charge for it.
Okay.
Have you watched this? My memory's not as good as it once was, but I have a short-term memory that of a case that we considered yesterday where there was one charge for a paralegal, something in the neighborhood of $100 an hour, and there was a charge for, I believe the terminology was legal assistant, somewhere in terms of $70. Have you watched that to see whether or not people, and I guess if they came under legal assistant, but really they shouldn't have been able to charge for a paralegal then, should they, under the prior law?
Under the
existing law.
Under the existing rule, I think they can charge a reasonable fee for a paralegal or legal assistant that meets the requirements of the current Supreme Court rule.
Even if they're named a paralegal as opposed to a legal assistant?
I think they're synonymous in my view. And I think that was the intent of the court when the rule was initially adopted. I'm not familiar with the case that the court heard yesterday. What I can observe is I do watch what lawyers are charging, what rates the lawyers are charging for their paralegals. The most common rate that I've seen runs at $50 an hour. I would not personally be offended if it was 75 and probably is justifiable. I have not seen, the $50 figure is something that I saw several years ago, and it struck me as that's reasonable. The lawyer's rate is running 175. To the extent that they can hire a paralegal and they can charge the client $50 or even $75 an hour, we have accomplished one of those goals, is professional services, yet we're holding the cost of those services down for the benefit of our clients.
Is there any ceiling on what they can charge once they're named a paralegal?
We don't have a bright line rule. I can tell you that if a complaint comes in to the disciplinary board based on a billing, an alleged billing abuse, and if they're billing out, if the lawyer's billing out at 150 and they're billing out their paralegal time at 125, that lawyer is going to be brought in and have to explain and justify, because the rules of professional conduct require that all lawyer bills be reasonable. And I think that if the lawyer's billing out a paralegal at 125, I don't think that's reasonable, because it ought not to be a profit center. In other words, if the lawyer's paying this paralegal $40,000 a year and they're billing it out at $100,000 a year, I believe that that would violate the rules as they exist today.
You can't account for overhead in the amount the paralegal gets billed out at?
Well, I'm not suggesting that you can't, you cannot extrapolate out, and that you can't charge for some overhead or the health care benefits or that kind of package. But I don't believe that the lawyer can in essence treat the paralegal just as they would a brand new law student that just got done clerking for the Supreme Court. I don't think they're different.
I don't mean to be smart alecky, but is the standard what you do or don't believe? Is that the standard on what they can charge?
We haven't had the issue. No, Justice, it isn't. I think that if and when that issue reaches the disciplinary board, they're going to read the annotated model rules and the annotations. It hasn't been an issue here. I suspect it's been an issue that has been addressed in other jurisdictions. We simply never addressed it. I'm giving you my comments were a gut reaction. There is no bright line with regard to charging for paralegals. There is a very bright line on lawyer fees, and that bootstraps in paralegal fees.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Barnett.
Let me follow up on one thing. Okay, I think we got the money figured out now, but what about holding this person out to the public? Do you have the rule there?
I do not.
On page 2, item number 2, the last 5 lines, this rule shall apply, et cetera, et cetera. You see that?
I'm sorry, Justice, I'm not with you.
It's, this rule shall apply to all unlicensed persons employed by a licensed attorney who are represented to the public or clients as possessing training which qualifies them to assist.
Thank you, Dean. And your question, Justice?
Okay, so my question would be, prospectively, if this passes, then you would not be able to represent to the public that your legal assistant possesses training and education which allows them to assist you in handling their legal affairs. Would that be fair?
I think that's a fair reading.
And then the same thing, if you go 2 pages further on, page 4, about right in the middle of the page, there's a subsection 3. You see that? This is it's item number 4, and it's what a paralegal can and cannot do. This is putting them on the letterhead. You see that?
No, I'm sorry, Justice. Give me the rule cite and
it's rule 4 of the last sentence.
It's
I've got the rule, but I don't have the
16.18.34.2
last sentence.
Subparagraph 3, the very last.
Okay.
So now I'll give you a chance to read it. We wouldn't be able to put on letterhead so and so legal assistant. prospective. Would that be right?
I think that's correct. I think they can be currently, you can list them on your letterhead, assuming that they meet the current rule qualifications. Either they can be characterized as legal assistant or paralegal. Prospectively, all those people who are already on the letterhead is a representation that by the lawyer that they have either gone to the paralegal school or they have certified them in-house, and they can continue to be on there, but they wouldn't call them legal assistant. They would call them paralegal.
And then the next step is, if they choose not to qualify the person, they could not put him on the letterhead as a legal assistant.
I think that's a fair reading.
Okay, thank you.
I have one more question to either one of you. If you, do you know the number of people this might affect? Or just have a ballpark number?
I don't have an idea. Terry, do you know how many people are in your organization? Over 100? There's over 100 people in the South Dakota Paralegal Association.
Okay, that would be certified and fit and would not have to go through any additional train or certification?
The number actually is probably much higher because there's a lot of people that aren't members of the South Dakota Paralegal Association that work in offices
okay,
all over
so
the state.
So they would not be affected at all?
As long as they...
So we're changing the name.
The changing the legal assistant to paralegal really doesn't... Okay. If they're qualified under the statute, it wouldn't affect
them. How many
them. Then
are not qualified that would lose because of that?
There probably aren't really all that many going forward. There's going to be people now in the future that are going to either have to be certified or go to school. And you know, 20 years ago, there were no paralegal schools. Nobody even knew what a paralegal was. People still don't know what my students are in my classroom and don't know what paralegals do sometimes. But, you know, going forward, I think that it will raise the bar for that profession. And you know, really, we certify the girl at the nail salon and the, you know, everybody's got licensing in every profession, and so I just think it's some place to start.
Okay.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Justice Sabres is going to go get his file, and he thought that might have a few other questions from him. We'll just wait for a second until he returns. Any other proponents for the rule change?
I'd like to report that my short-term memory is not even very good. The billing was for an associate attorney rather than a paralegal, and then the other billing was for a legal assistant. So that's an immaterial matter.
Okay. All right. No other proponents, then opponents. Mr. Nacer.
Please the court and counsel. This bill eliminates any middle ground. There is no such thing under this bill as a legal assistant. And it's for the exact reason that Justice Zinder has pointed out, and that is that anyone who is doing substantively this work is now a paralegal and is subject to the certification rule. And so that's this overbreadth in the bill in general is my opposition. That's the reason I'm opposed to it. I'm not opposed to all aspects of the bill, and I certainly respect the effort here. But I believe we need to regulate people who are in the legal profession, even in that strata of paralegal, legal assistant. However, when Justice Zinner points out that it applies to all unlicensed persons employed by a licensed attorney representing to the public that they're handling legal matters, that applies to my investigator too. That applies to the police officer that I have on my contract, where I send him to interview a client, and I don't even charge for that time most of the time, but he's not going to be able to perform that function. He is precluded from performing it simply because he is being held out as possessing the training and education that qualifies him to assist in the handling of legal matters. The bill is simply overbroad, Your Honors.
Where exactly are you?
This is 16-18-34. That's the sentence, the last sentence of the paragraph. That's what Justice Zinter has been focusing on.
But that sentence has not changed, has it?
But now, if you are extending it to, see, it's the overall effect, because now you're eliminating people who aren't certified from the ability to do these functions set forth in that last sentence of Section 2 of 16-18-34. Before, we didn't have to worry about it because they were the in-house counsel trained people. And believe me, there are many more than are being suggested here. Most of the small practitioners that I know don't have certified paralegals on staff. Certified paralegals generally come to your office and say, I don't want to do secretarial work. My position is that of a paralegal. I've been educated for it. I don't want to be a secretary. And they have that right, and I respect that. But that doesn't fill my need. If I'm correct, Your Honors, I respectfully submit that I have over 33 years of private practice, probably more than anybody in this room, and I have never had a board-certified or a certified paralegal. I've had many legal assistants or paralegals that I've trained to do exactly what I needed them to do, and they've been good and they've been competent. And in fact, as I've pointed out in my letters, this is not about my wife, Carol. We'll survive whether she's a legal assistant or not. But the fact is, people do call her from all over the state because she knows that area that we practice in. Now, why would we require her then to have an education that is broader than is necessary for what we're doing in our office?
I thought she's grandfathered in.
I'm sorry?
My understanding from the representation is that she's working for
you
at this
time. She will be until recertification time. Then there's an ambiguity in this bill that I wanted to point out, because people have to be recertified periodically. She will be grandfathered in and continue to be, but the effect of the recertification requirement has yet to be determined. And so that needs clarification also. But you see, most of the practitioners in our rural areas are doing taxes, they're doing probates, they're doing these sorts of things. And why do they need somebody who can do legal research in a personal injury case or can pass a certification test in those areas? There's simply no need for it in a small rural state like ours. And so that, at least that's my feeling. And I don't really know that board-certified paralegals get a lot of jobs except in the larger firms. Now, I know there's no general statement to that. By the way, I want to say that, Justice Meyer Henry, I think you should not accept, and this is with great respect for my dear friend, Mr. Barnett, it was not a 90-10 split at the bar. It was very close to 50-50. And we were at the same meeting, and I'm stunned to hear 90-10, because there were tremendous numbers of people that listened to what I had to say, and I was the only speaker in opposition, and Mariah was the only person speaking for the bill. And I think John Song, for example, in Sioux Falls called me, and he said, it bothers me that I voted to approve this report, because I thought we were only approving the committee report, not that we were endorsing the recommendation that we pass this bill. And I said, John, I think a lot of people had that understanding at the bar meeting. I believe the ones who voted against it didn't, but Among those who voted for it, I believe there was some confusion. And so...
we still, since then, we've published these now, and I think you're the only person who submitted a letter in opposition.
Well, and I'm guessing that most of your published bills don't receive a lot of comment one way or the other, in all honesty. I try to pride myself on watching out for the bar. That's all I can tell you, is that I take these things very seriously, and I try to give you the benefit of a viewpoint.
Okay. What would you?
I want to ask you the same question. Do you have any idea how many people this will affect?
No. And I don't think anybody does, and I don't think the bill has been researched properly in that regard to determine the effect on the legal system.
Do you have a proposal or an amendment or suggested changes to the bill, or is your preference just to throw the baby out with the bathwater?
The main objection that I've been pounding on over and over since I read this is that we've eliminated the in-house training of lawyers. We're saying under this bill...
Did you misspeak? You said in-house training of lawyers.
Yes. You mean of the paralegals. In-house training of lawyers of their paralegals.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I have always been careful to tell the secretaries that come in and want to go further with this work that you have to do what I say, basically, and learn this profession for 2 years minimum as a legal assistant, not just doing secretarial, but doing this other work under my auspices. And never have we charged for anybody who didn't meet the qualifications under 6 and 7, the ones that are being deleted under 16.18.34.1. And so... Now, I don't do much hourly work anymore. It's primarily contingency work. And so this doesn't necessarily affect my billings at all. We're going to continue to pretty much do the same thing, except that I am tremendously bothered by the same thing Justice Zinner pointed out, and that is that by eliminating my right to in-house train people to assist me in the handling of legal matters or document presentation, I can't use them legally for that unless they're certified. I can't have them interact with my clients.
So wouldn't your proposed changes or suggestion be to include, a secondary category that includes all types of legal assistance and either permit a reasonable charge for their services or permit the in-house training of them by the lawyer?
Yes. Yes. Now, I don't think we need to break out a secondary category necessarily. I guess you would have to if we want to focus on elevating the position of the certified legal assistant or paralegal.
Which is the push.
Yeah.
Which
and
is
that's
the
main push on
thrust
this.
Of
and
the...
I do respect that issue. I respect that effort. I respect anybody who goes to the training, the necessity of the training, and is trying to be better at their profession. That's a good thing. The bad thing is we're taking a lot of very qualified people and we're going to put them out of work, or we're going to relegate them to a lesser scale of pay, and we are going to give a monopoly to the certifieds, which will increase the cost of legal services because it will be a monopoly, and it will they will be the only ones who will be allowed to hold themselves out as having the training and education. And so I think the answer for the short term, Your Honors, is to put back in Sections 6 and 7 so we can in-house train these people, just like we've been doing. And then long term, perhaps categorize the legal assistants. And then if we want to have a board certified one, a doctor doesn't have to be board certified in order to practice surgery. He can hold himself out as being board certified. And that's good. And we can then judge for ourselves as members of the public whether or not that we want to do business with them. But it doesn't mean that everybody else is unqualified. And it doesn't mean that I'm not competent anymore to provide the kind of staff and legal services for the community that I want to provide, and I don't want to have to pay for somebody to be able to pass a test in other areas than I practice in, because it just doesn't make sense. And I'm willing to bet that many of the sole practitioners and smaller firms across the state would agree with me if this came up. I did truly see a lot of support against this bill, and when I argued it in front of the bar, I focused on this 6 and 7 that they're eliminating, the in-house training.
Would it be okay? Would it be okay if that was back in?
Yes, that certainly is a very good thing. Now, I don't know if it'll work in the long run, but perhaps we should have a special certification level for those people. To be honest with you, I've always felt you leave it a little too much in our hands, perhaps. Maybe we should have to apply to you for permission to treat that person as a legal assistant. Maybe we should. I had that thought when I read this rule over 10 years ago. And there isn't anybody who's being asked to certify that that person did in fact have the required 2 years in their office of training. And what does that mean? And so, like I said, there are people like me that take it very seriously because we're concerned about our work in the profession. There are other people who are going to play it a little fast and loose. I'd like to see a license, quite frankly, in the long term for anybody who is being held out as doing this kind of work. Perhaps investigators ought to also have a license, because accident investigators and reconstructionists and all these various people, when we have nurses, when we have them on staff, we are saying they have special training and education that qualifies them to assist in the handling of their legal matter.
But that's a little bit of a red herring. I mean, I was focusing on that sentence, the last sentence you just read. But this change wouldn't have anything to do with nurses and private investigators and others that you employ, because I mean, you've got that problem under the existing rule.
You would have that problem. That's right.
I mean, if we do nothing, you've got this.
Yes, you would have. So it's an overbroad statement. But
yeah, so the problem is maybe with the existing language, not the change that's being proposed.
Well, and I agree with that, and I think that now, before we were trying to slice this definition of who these people are so thinly, and then we looked to apply it to this, before we were feeling more comfortable that it was a broader statement or should be interpreted as a broader statement. And I didn't worry about who I worked with in that regard. I would not personally, I do not hire employees in my office to do functions that a paralegal should do. I may hire an outside expert. I hire an independent contractor police officer, and I let them know he's an independent contractor. And that's how we pay for these things as well. I bill for an independent contractor's time when I do it. Just like I'd hire an expert witness. The people know they're not in my office. And I don't think I have the right to have people in my office under my umbrella doing this function legally and holding themselves out to the public that way. Now, you may want to read it a little more loosely, but if you take it the way it's written, it does apply. And it would apply especially, Your Honors, if we do in fact eliminate Section 6 and 7.
Thank you.
I have a question about that last sentence, not necessarily a reason, maybe of the drafter. That,
excuse me, the 6 and 7.
The old rule would have applied to unlicensed persons. Under the new rule, it only applies to licensed persons. Isn't that the key? I mean, that's the concern. This particular sentence, and maybe I'm...
Which sentence are you reading?
Okay, the last one on 16.18.34, the last sentence that Mr. Nacer was discussing.
This rule shall apply to all unlicensed
yes,
persons.
Yes, and he's saying now it broad brushes a lot of people that... because we've taken out 5 and 6. Does this sentence need to be in there in the way it's expressed now that you've changed the proposals in this rule? Because the old rule, there was no certification license requirement. So the whole old rule applied to unlicensed persons. Well, but under the new rule, now people will be licensed. So what is the...
Well, they won't be licensed, actually. Licensure is a different issue, okay. Which is like as attorneys, so we're licensed. These
how
people.
How do you answer then the broad brush on this thing? Can it be more specific than so you aren't? Investigators, people like that. I mean, you. I don't. It probably.
I think this is defining who a paralegal is, and so. They're not licensed people. It sets forth the qualifications of who a paralegal is. And these are the rules that...
People who assist in handling of legal matters or document preparation could be a secretary. It's really
broad... In some offices, yes.
It's really broad. So...
Well, that's the problem anytime you change any word. then you got to go back and figure out what other things that changed. So,
it may have
and
made
that could
sense
be.
Before because you weren't requiring the certification and so forth, but and you could train. But
right.
Does it now apply under the new rules? So I just question.
I don't think that is
too broad of a statement.
Maybe.
Here.
I don't have a good answer for you.
Okay. Are there any other replies that you would wish, Ms. Roman? Are there any other replies to Mr. Nasser's comments? Okay. All right. Any other responses from anybody on these rules? All right. Then we'll move on to the next two rules. They're also the final two rules. And these are proposed by Mr. Nasser. And these would be the amendments to 1960 and 8.3 and 8.4. And this time you're the proponent, so you go first.
A few years ago, I was unable to be at the rules meeting to defend a bill that I had proposed in that regard, in the same regard. That was a custom-drafted bill where I tried to streamline the legislation I found in the state of Texas. And although I've never even been to San Antonio, I'm a member of the San Antonio Trial Lawyers Association because they have a progressive listserv down there. And so I've always admired that. So I see what they do down there sometimes. This bill is virtually verbatim, this proposal is virtually verbatim out of the Texas rule. And I would add that there are similar rules. I didn't do a complete state count, but I did send an inquiry on the listserv at ATLA and at SATLA, the San Antonio Trial Lawyers. And I asked people to tell me if they had similar rules to the Texas rule. And I received information that Massachusetts, under General Law 233, Section 796, has one. Florida does. I do not have a cite. Georgia, 24-7-8 and 9 of the OCGA. Connecticut, 52-174 for physicians' affidavits. And 4-104 for hospitals. They have two separate sections there. In Connecticut, they also have a case law that the plaintiff can put it in. That's 622 Southeast 395. And it goes to the jury when the plaintiff puts it in. That those are my bills. There's a presumption then that they're fair and reasonable and required by the injury, for treatment of the injury.
You had an opportunity to review the objections by Lisa Hansen Marshall of Boyce Greenfield,
no.
Ed Evans of Davenport Evans.
I haven't seen those. No one has furnished me with those. Missouri 490.525, Maryland 10-104, and Rhode Island 9-19-27. Now, the practical aspect of this, Your Honors, is that most of the time it's not a problem anyway, because counsel do stipulate, probably in about 80% of the cases, I'm guessing, when we get ready for a trial, we will have a pretrial conference and we will stipulate to the medical bills and the fact that anybody that wants to use one of the furnished medical records can use it with the assumption that it's a true medical record, so you don't require authentication. There are times, however, where counsel won't stipulate. So then the next procedure is, and frankly, they're just being stubborn. And so, or their client is and won't let them. And so then what happens is you send them a request for admission, one at a time, every bill attached to it, and they deny them. Okay, now, I then went to the step years ago of not only sending the request for admission, but having an interrogatory behind it and say, tell me your witnesses who are going to actually deny this bill, who are really serious about denying it. And they will normally dodge that because they can't, they don't have anything, okay? It's just that they don't want to admit something. And so, consequently, the way I'm seeing this, like in these other states, we know that an injured person gets a bill. They get it from the doctor, and the thing that they should be able to do when that bill comes from the doctor is say to the jury, this is the bill I got from the doctor. It's a presumptively, it's his usual charge, or if we are concerned about that, the doctor's office can file an affidavit saying it's their usual charge. But the jury ought to be able to consider that. Now, that doesn't mean that it is automatically entitled to a directed verdict in the amount of the medical bills, because we still would have to satisfy the jury that the causation is in place and that it is directly related to this accident or whatever we're dealing with. And so this is simply to get beyond the authentication and to get beyond the to get the bill to the jury so that then they can listen to the evidence presented by the physicians as to whether it's related.
Mr. Nasser, I don't see how this rule would do anything that a request for admission. I mean, if you took all the bills, stapled them together, sent one request for admission and an interrogatory, and if the interrogatory said exactly what's in subsection F here.
Mm-hmm. What I'm telling you, Your Honor, is that it doesn't work because it's too easy to deny.
Well, why would this be any different if you simply put exactly what you're saying is that the party opposing, if they're going to oppose, they've got to fill out this affidavit or create an affidavit identifying what's in F, which basically is the reasons why they're going to controvert the matters. Now, what does this add to the rules when you could put this exact language in F in an interrogatory, mm-hmm. and it seems to me accomplish the same thing?
Well, for one thing, under the current rule, even if they don't list anybody as a witness in response to my interrogatory, it still doesn't go in. It still doesn't go in without me getting the doctor in every provider. I've got to get the doctor or their custodian or someone to be able to testify, take a deposition, and get it into evidence. Now, I know that when I send that request for admission, it gets denied. Everybody denies them. They simply don't admit it. They refused to admit it. That's where we're at. They don't have anybody backing them up, but that's the way it's left. And so then we put it right back on me and people in my position to go out to every single doctor, if necessary, before the trial. See? And all it is a waste of time. It's a total, complete waste of time. If they, in fact, have a genuine challenge, we will bring it to a head with that affidavit. It'll be expedient, it'll help the court, it'll help counsel, and that's what these other states are finding out.
But again, why wouldn't it be brought to head with an interrogatory?
Because it will be dodged. And then you've got to, you see, what this will do is it will get it to the jury unless there is a substantive rebuttal. If you have the interrogatory and it's not admitted, I'm no further ahead. That's where we are.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nasser. Other proponents for this rule, Mr. Tellinghausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. Roger Telling Hughes on behalf of the South Dakota Trial Lawyers Association. We've already submitted a letter in support of Mr. Nacer's proposed rule, and I'm just here today to reiterate that our association has reviewed this and discussed it with Mr. Nacer. We believe that it would be an efficient promotion of the ends of justice and would lead to significant cost savings to our clients. And we'd appreciate your support.
Have you had an opportunity to review the objections of Ed Evans, Tom Welk, Roger Sudbeck, Lisa Hansen Marceau, and the other people who have objected?
Justice Sabers, I have not.
Why don't we take a 10-minute recess, and I'll give them my copies, and then Mr. Nacer and anyone else can read these. And
good. Thank you.
Telling you.
Thank you.
Would it be better to have them respond in writing?
We'd be happy to do that.
I'd like to hear it.
All right. Whatever the court wants to do. We're in recess for 10 minutes. Mr. Tellinghuis, I think you had the floor when we took our recess.
Thank you. I have had the opportunity to quickly read the letters filed with the court in opposition to this proposed rule, and at the risk of oversimplifying what I understand to be their principal objection, I will state what I understand to be their principal objection, and that is that this rule, if adopted, would allow for the submission to the jury or the fact finder these costs with a determination that they are reasonable and were medically necessary, thereby placing some undue burden upon the defense side of the case. And I don't think that's a fair reading of the proposed rule. Proposed rule simply is a mechanism that could be employed in what is now kind of what I would call the gap, if you will, between those cases that Mr. Nacer identified, the 80% of the cases where these records are stipulated to. Both counsel agree that they'll be submitted to the jury. There won't be an argument as to their reasonableness or their necessity. And those cases then over here on the far end of the spectrum where for no good apparent reason defense counsel is not going to stipulate to those records being introduced, thereby placing both parties to the expense of having to bring in some expert witness to substantiate what should really be an uncontroverted fact as to the reasonableness of the charges and the medical necessity of the service that was provided. And this rule will simply allow then the filing of the affidavit and place the other side in a position of having to respond. If they truly have a legitimate objection or disagreement with either the reasonableness or the medical necessity of the costs, they then can respond. And what's happening is that under our current civil procedure rules that we have available to us, the filing of a request for admissions, even coupled with an interrogatory, they're not being responded to, as Mr. Nacer said, in a meaningful way. Now, granted, a plaintiff's attorney could file a motion to compel, and we could bring it back in front of the court. And my experience with motions to compel have been that in appropriate cases, the courts have been good about instructing the other side to furnish an answer to the interrogatory. But not always do we get the complete answer, and we're either left in a position of throwing up our hands and saying, well, we'll just fight it out when we get into the courtroom, or we go back on another motion to compel. And I really believe that the rule that's been proposed by Mr. Nacer is one that will fill this gap better than the rules or the statutes that we have available to us today.
This in essence really just gives you a bigger hammer than Rule 37 sanctions, basically, is what it all comes down to.
I believe so. Yes.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, yeah.
Any other proponents? If not, any opponents?
If I may.
Mr. Nacer.
There is one comment in Ed Evans's letter that is, I believe, a couple of comments that are incorrect. This does not take away from the jury the right to resolve causation or any of the other legitimate substantive issues. It simply gives it to the jury so that they can resolve those things. Anybody, it does not, like I said, it doesn't result in a directed verdict on the question of the reasonableness, necessity, and relatedness of the medical bills.
It permits the plaintiff to put that issue of causation to the jury by the use of an accountant or somebody who takes care of the accounts or a filing clerk or something by their affidavit, and requires a counter by someone who is experienced and who is qualified to answer that.
Correct. And as I see this, this is no more than a variation of the business records rule. It really isn't any different than that. We're putting it before the jury. It's admissible. It's not kept out by hearsay. And they have to still do the fact finding.
Except the business record custodian is merely certifying that they're accurate records. Here, we're going one step further and saying that these are reasonable medical charges and that they were necessary.
It does give a presumption.
So that goes quite a ways beyond
right.
what a custodian of a medical record would say.
That is true. It does go just a hair further. But the fact is, if it's a medical bill, how many times have you had medical bills in your life or even seen them that anybody would really argue that it was related to what you're saying it's related to on the bill, and that the charge was reasonable or, it was within the realm of reasonableness? And so it's common experience for everyone that this rule is enacting common experience, and then saying in those cases where common experience should not be allowed to govern, and someone truly challenges this on the merits, then all they have to do is challenge it, and then we know. But what we're saying to you is that there is a gap of ingenuineness in the treatment of medical bills by the defense on occasion. And this deals with that ingenuineness. It doesn't affect the vast majority of cases, as you can tell from the people who responded to you. They say we usually don't have any trouble doing this.
If they do that ingenuinely, then of course, and you prove it up, then those are costs that can be taxed against them, right?
Only the deposition costs if you do. First of all, you can't have the loss of time back for a plaintiff's lawyer. It takes a tremendous amount of time, and you have to bother a lot of citizenry when someone will not be forthright. This is simply saying, all right, if you want to object, then put it under oath. Make your objection. Be serious about it. Don't give us one of these BS objections. Don't do that. Just give us the truth. That's all we're talking about.
And then once the counter affidavit comes in, then it's
then
back to square one.
Back to square one.
We have to bring in
the
people.
Because they meant it, and they had a legitimate issue, and they brought the issue in.
What about the objection that the time frame that you've set up here is getting a little bit too close to the trial?
I don't read that that way. Ed seemed to misconstrue the rule. It's not that you can serve this with the summons and complaint and then require somebody. You can't do that. They should have to file their counter affidavit well in advance of the trial. I don't mind different time limits. I'm not saying this is gospel. It's how they do it in Texas, and it seems to work. That's all I can tell you.
Have you thought about, rather than setting up a whole other parallel procedure with different time limits and rules, rather than doing that, just inserting the extra hammer that you want someplace in Rule 37?
I have never gotten terms ever. and I think it's a waste of time. So, to be honest with you, I don't think Rule 37 is effective that way. I just
amending
don't,
37.
What's that?
Have you thought about amending 37 to give you, you know, a presumption that the record's coming in, say?
Isn't that really what we're doing, in a sense? I wouldn't mind doing it through some other vehicle. This is giving a kind of a background hidden presumption that when the doctor bills you, it's his bill, and he's going to say it's reasonable, and that it was for whatever he treated. That's all. It's a presumption of that implicit. And if we wanted to call it a formal presumption, we could. But that's essentially what we're doing.
But, you know, I guess what bothered me is a little bit is that, you know, it isn't the doctor saying that this is reasonable. It's going to be a boilerplate affidavit where you're just going to fill in the blanks, and then you're going to take it to some filing clerk, and the filing clerk is going to be saying it's reasonable and the expenses were reasonable. What else are they going to say? Because otherwise they're fired. And it's necessary. And they have no concept as to whether it's necessary, not even really qualified to say it's necessary.
Yeah, I would say that the only time your comment is important is in the event that there is a challenge, a legitimate factual challenge. Because otherwise the presumption would carry, this hidden, so to speak, presumption, this inference that when you give a bill, it's the guy's bill and it's reasonable. And he's going to say it every time. I've never had anybody say this is not a reasonable charge for my services. And so in those events, Your Honor, where that is a concern substantively, then it's dealt with by the counter affidavit. And they should deal with it by the counter affidavit.
Thank you. Any other proponents for these proposals? Any opponents? Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is John Brown. I am actually happen to be a registered lobbyist on the third floor for the South Dakota Defense Lawyers Association. You have received from Craig Fifely, president of our association, his letter in objection to the proposed rule change along with the other letters that you've identified. Frankly, I don't know that I can add a lot to the arguments here. This is not a field that I plow frequently on a personal basis. However, it does appear that we are proposing in this to change well-established hearsay rules through business records exception that may not be appropriate. And it appears to me that really all we're doing with this proposal is not really changing the battle, but perhaps changing the battlefield by requiring or allowing this affidavit to be put in place and then requiring that the defense propose a counter affidavit, which has been pointed out. The counter affidavit has to be presented by persons that show they have some training experience or particular expertise, knowledge, or skill with related to the affidavit, a requirement that isn't in place for the original affidavit in the first instance. As has been pointed out, a records custodian could be making an affidavit on charges that are reasonable and necessary, which appears to go well beyond the particular training or knowledge that individual would have themselves. There are some problems also with the time frames. It lays out a 30-day time frame before evidence is first introduced at trial when this initial affidavit has to be filed and allows the defense to respond within 30 days, but then also sets a 14-day before trial time period when that affidavit should be in. It does provide for leave the court to introduce it at another time, but it frankly, it's a little vague in that regard. It appears to me at least that the circumstances of this rule, as I said, is really just going to change the battlefield. those same issues that have arisen during our ordinary evidentiary proceedings are now going to be shifted to an affidavit contest and, frankly, set out for the courts a different procedure where they're going to have to make rulings. And as been pointed out, this is something that by and large is settled by affidavits or by stipulations of the parties. In at least 80% of the cases, it doesn't appear that that a new rule is needed in this regard.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
You don't think a new rule is needed in the 20% of cases that aren't covered by stipulation?
Yeah, I think certainly through the evidentiary or the discovery rules, in Rule 37 has been brought up, and perhaps that needs some more enforcement or some clarification to provide for enforcement in those circumstances where defense in a case is being just simply obstructionist. But to set out a new procedure, I think unnecessarily complicates legal processes.
You know, Mr. Brown, I'm as guilty as anybody. And anecdotally, I've got to admit, I don't think sanctions are really probably awarded every time they probably should be. And I don't know that the battlefield is equal right now. You know, as far as this particular area, I mean, is there anything that that you know of that's been done to kind of equalize that situation? Because you just don't see terms really being given when maybe they should be in some of these cases.
Yeah, I can't argue with you that perhaps terms should be granted more frequently than they are. I don't know how to resolve that necessarily. It does concern me, however, that this proposal is somewhat of a burden-shifting proposal, certainly not on the underlying cause of action, but it's burden-shifting with respect to a specific discovery rule. And I think maybe that goes too far.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
Since this is a rather informal proceeding, we have an additional question for Ms. Roman Rogers. Would you please come back up? Sure. Justice Koenigsberg.
Well, I'm just looking at this. I think Mr. Nason makes an awfully good point that this 16-18-34, the last sentence, is overbroad. I wonder if there wouldn't be, at least to that concern, if there isn't just a simple way to fix it. Where it says, you know, this rule shall apply to all unlicensed persons employed by a licensed attorney who are represented to the public or clients as possessing training or education, etc. Why not just strike everything beginning with possessing and just say, as a paralegal as described in this chapter?
I don't personally have any objection to that.
Because the definition of paralegal is already given earlier in this section. All right, that was my only question.
Okay. Thank you. I guess everybody's had their say.
I saw Mr. Nasser nodding his head.
I'd have to study it a little bit in the context of the whole act, but it seems that that's what we're getting at, is as long as you can allow the 6 and 7 to stay in, that in-house training is still allows you to hold these people out as being capable of helping you in your cases, then that would work.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nasser. Yes, ma'am. If you would do it at the podium, this is on the internet and it doesn't pick up well back there.
I'm Terry Brown from the South Dakota Paralegal Association. And I just wanted to let you know that those two sections of the code that we had struck, the 6 and 7, the main purpose for those being taken out, that there was nothing that said what the in-house training consisted of. And then the portion of on number 6, it has a minimum of 3 years of law-related experience. Does that mean a receptionist plus six months in house training can be a paralegal? And that's where the confusion is. And it doesn't say what does that training consist of. And by adding or simplifying it to either certification or education, there are two certifying exams that have years of experience as qualifications. So we're saying if you have the years of experience and you have been trained, take the test and show that. And with having, and the test, just like the test from the National Association of Legal Assistants, there's several portions on that test, and there's only one section that has to do with substantive law. And you can choose three areas. And that area is only 2 hours of a two-day test. So if Mr. Nasser has, if his paralegal works in, say, three different areas, whether it be civil, maybe some family law, and sorry, I'm not familiar with your practice, or even some contract work, you can be limited to which areas of the substantive law sections you want to take. Select about 10. There's 10 selections, and you would select three. But the test also encompasses ethics, communications, and judgment and analytical ability. And if there was some, and I can't speak for my organization to say to put those back in, because those were the main reasons why we felt this needed to be changed, because there wasn't anything to say what that training was. And if there was something that added a certification signed by the attorney saying, this is what I did to train this person, we're not going to, you know, argue with what an attorney says that he did to train his paralegal. But it was just too broad the way it was, and that's why we were trying to simplify it.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry, one other thing. The certifying, to be recertified, that his current paralegal wouldn't have to be recertified because she's not certified right now. That only has to do with those of us who currently have a certification. I've been certified for 15 years, and every 5 years I show that I've taken CLEs, 50 hours of CLEs, 10 per year, and that's all it takes to be recertified.
Because people who are grandfathered in don't have to be recertified.
They don't have to be certified to begin with.
Okay.
And they would still be, if they qualify right now under the statute, they still qualify until they no longer work. It's everybody else who's coming in fresh that would need to be doing that or have an education. I mean, you could have a 2-year degree as a paralegal and not be certified. And under the current statute, you do not have to be certified. But you would, if you were only going to be doing it by on-the-job training, you would need to be certified or have the degree.
You know, I think maybe at this point to straighten everything out, because we've had a lot of discussion here this morning about this clause and that clause. And it might be helpful to the court if you have any proposed changes in the text from what's printed here, submit it in writing within 10 days so we know specifically what we're talking about, and I, too, don't have to rely on a faltering short-term memory. Is that okay with everybody?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, if you don't have any, fine. But if you're talking about you think this needs to be tweaked, it would probably work better if we saw it in writing.
And I would only want to tweak it if something else was put in, and that's my confusion was, because I thought if you just decided to put those two sections back in, then it would change everything, and we would almost say we would want you to change anything at all.
Well, I think you can pretty well assume that, because that's what this gentleman has asked we do.
Right.
So
you're saying if we put five and six or six and seven
back in,
if we put it back in, you just assume not have any of it.
Right.
Okay.
All right.
That we would want to come back with a totally different proposal, and I don't know what that would be right now, but I got to believe that would be true. We'd rather start from scratch and try to eliminate some of these other confusions, and start with maybe something that says the attorney will certify, but then you're getting into a whole different area on what consists of in-house training. And are you just going to rely on the attorney that says this is what they did? I mean, I think six needs to stay out anyway, because that's where we're talking about 3 years of law-related experience, and we don't know what that is. But if you do the on-the-job training, I don't think 2 years is enough. You know, so that's why I'm saying we would want to tweak it even more.
I think what we're saying is we would like to have your position in writing, mm-hmm. and if you're dead set against anything other than what's proposed, then I guess you tell us that in writing, okay. because it looks like there's going to be some changes, and we want to know where you stand.
Okay.
And that's 10 days?
10 days.
And what about the suggestion I made on that sentence, too? Did you hear what I suggested?
Yes, and I don't disagree with that.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we'll wait to hear from all parties within 10 days, and then we'll have at it. So thank you, everybody, for coming. We're in recess.